trees of green, red roses too. I see them bloom for me and you, and I think to myself, what a wonderful world.
And that music means it's time for the Davis Garden Show. This is Don Shore.
And this is Lois Richter on a bright, beautiful, sunny Davis day. It is August. It is gorgeous. It is cool compared to what it was a few weeks ago.
Yeah, it's pretty
I think
nice.
We're about average, aren't we?
Very, very close to average. Although today, according to the National Weather Service, today being August 19th, as we record the show for broadcast on August 20, 2026, they say it's going to get up to 97 degrees here in Davis at the University Airport. The Sacramento reading not far away was showing 95 degrees just a few minutes ago. So a little warmer today than it's been the last few days. We were 94 yesterday, according to the Simms Weather Station, which is west side of campus. Tonight will be 60 degrees and mostly clear. I don't see a cloud in the sky right now. It's beautiful, sparkling, sunny out there. As I look out my window right now, this is August. I see blooming marigolds, fruiting sweet peppers, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 different varieties of turning color. Across the yard, I see petunias blooming, and I'm not even a big fan of petunias, but these are spectacular. I see celosias, I see amaranthus. It's a pretty classic mid-August garden right now for all of us. We're going to go up to a high tomorrow of 94 degrees. Thursday night will be 61 degrees. Friday will be 92 degrees. Friday night will be 60. Saturday, here we go, 92. Sunday, 92. Monday, 88. Tuesday, 88. Lows at night, 60, 59, and 58. So basically right around or slightly below average as we get through the weekend. Cooler conditions as you head further into the mountains. Obviously, warmest conditions today through Friday. Cooling over the weekend and into next week with a weak trough. Trough means cooler air moving over Northern California. As it moves through the region, the winds will become breezy through the Delta. Boy, that's been happening for the last week. Delta winds gusting up to 20 knots during the evening hours, helping to cool off temperatures and increasing humidity values. We have definitely seen that pattern for the last 10 to 14 days where Delta breeze is coming in Dixon 4 o'clock, 5 o'clock in the afternoon. Typically, it's more in the 6, 7, 8 p.m. period. So it's coming in earlier. It's coming in strong. We've had 10 and 20 mile an hour winds out here, cooling off so nicely that you can just open the windows and let the house cool off, even if it did get into the 90s. The weather pattern for this last 10 days or so, the highest temperature was 94 degrees yesterday. Before that, we were 92, 84, 79 degrees in some areas, 80 degrees. That was a week ago. So well below average earlier in the week and basically low 90s before that, except about 10 to 14 days ago, we were actually 95 to 100. So for the last 10 days, we've had very good tomato fruit set weather. That's what I'm coming around to after all that conversation there. We have had very good flowering on the plants. They're continuing to set, and we've had almost 10 days of it. So somewhere in that period, if your plants were adequately irrigated and growing well, you should have a whole nother late season crop of fruit coming on now. It's mid to late August. It takes about 7 weeks from blossom or fruit set to pick. In the case of an average tomato like an early girl, a little faster for smaller fruited ones, longer for big fruited ones, but 7 weeks from now puts us in the first week of October. That's a time that we're almost always able to be harvesting summer vegetables here. We're very rarely cold or rainy in early October. In fact, typically, first 1 to 2 weeks of October feel very summer-like here. So if you're growing tomatoes and they're petering out, your plants are looking tired, and you're done, you have enough, go ahead, pull most of them out, cut them back, whatever you want to do, and start interplanting with your cooler season vegetables. But if they look okay, they've got good vigor, give them a very deep soaking right now, maybe a light feeding if they're showing, if they're not deep green color, and you should get enough growth to sustain a whole nother set and a whole nother crop, essentially, of tomatoes late September and in through the month of October. Anyone who's been gardening here for a long time knows that we can often get tomatoes ripening well into even November because we're typically warm enough and dry enough through at least the first 3 weeks or so of October that the fruit will continue to ripen. Even if it doesn't fully ripen on the vine, you can pick it and bring it in and ripen it on your counter. So we can continue harvesting right on into mid-October almost for sure. Late October, you're finally beginning to feel fall-like and they're beginning to take things out at that point.
Don, you got to stop saying such wonderful things about Davis. You're going to have everybody in the world move here.
Tomatoes grow very well here.
They do. That's one of the main crops in our area.
It is the number one crop, I believe, both last year and the year before in Yolo County and Solano counties, bumping nut crops, walnuts and almonds off the first place list where they muscled their way up to about a decade ago. Tomatoes are back. Canning tomatoes. It's funny that it's been such a consistent crop here in all the years I've been here. I remember talking to a farmer about this years ago because it didn't seem like he'd make a lot of money on tomatoes. He said, no. But we know exactly how much we will make. At the time they plant them,
at
the time we plant them, we know how much yield we're going to get. It doesn't rain here in the summer, so we don't ever have crop loss because of rain or anything like that. And we know when we'll be taking them to the cannery, and we know exactly how much they're going to pay us. So we may only be earning 3 cents a pound or whatever number he came up with, but we know we'll get that much. Okay. Unlike, for example, the pistachio growers who are taking their crops to the nut processing facilities or doing a test on them and finding 40% of them didn't have nuts in them this year.
Shooting blanks again.
Shooting blanks, yes, to use the term, yes. Whereas tomatoes, you know how much you're going to get, you know what the quality is going to be, you know, it's a sort of a guaranteed income. Still the number one crop in the area. Tomatoes do very, very well here. And this is a pivotal time. Some people are switching over to cool season flowers, cool season vegetables, and just sort of letting the summer things play out or pulling out. Let's say you have three zucchini, pull out two of them, leave one of them. Leave a couple cucumbers if they're still growing. If they're still growing and flowering, they can still produce. And then beginning to shift over to the cool season stuff we talked about last week. But your tomatoes really do, and your peppers really do, have a full another half season to produce for you in this region, and especially the peppers.
So there was an email that you let me read part of, and it said, and this is, I forget who's writing this, Lacey and I went looking for late mid-season selections at their peak, only to discover that the mid to late August varieties were already past, and we were suddenly tasting what would normally be early September fruit on August 14th. Right. Now, is this tomato fruit or is this stone fruit? What kind of fruit are we talking about?
Oh, that was a comment by Ed Livo, who is a consultant on fruit trees and fruit sales and all that kind of stuff. He's been in the nursery industry for as long as I can remember, worked for Dave Wilson Nursery, Four Winds Growers, consults on fruit marketing and so forth, hosts fruit tastings. And this was, I believe, on his Facebook account. And he also posted a few weeks ago a very similar comment. And we've been getting this comment as well. Many stone fruit varieties, so not tomatoes, we're talking about fruit trees now, are at least a couple of weeks ahead of schedule for when they're ripening. This was true of my plums for sure. I have several plums down a row and they basically all ripened together, which was rather inconvenient. So they were, you know, I have Inca and I have late Santa Rosa, a late variety of Santa Rosa, and I had a Pluot, and usually these ripen in sequence. A couple of them would still be a couple of weeks out. I noticed 3 weeks ago, many of them were beginning to drop, which is either a sign that something is attacking the fruit commonly, or that they're ripening and falling. And they were, in fact, just ripening ahead of schedule. And I agree, it's about 2 to 3 weeks ahead of schedule for most of them. If you happen to have one of these varieties like Nubiana plum, Emerald Butte plum, those hang on the tree for several weeks. So even if they started ahead of schedule, there'll still be some hanging on there, we hope, at the what you might call the normal calendar time for picking those particular varieties. Others, like the Santa Rosa, just came down. And if you didn't deal with them, that was that. And everything does appear to be ahead of schedule by at least a couple of weeks, at least in the world of stone fruits. And some of my pears were dropping 3 to 4 weeks early as well. I definitely agree with Ed on that. It's been a very strange year for fruit set, very strange year from the agricultural standpoint. Probably has to do with the extremely bizarre nature of the chilling hours all over the state of California this year. Remember, November, December, January, for half of that period, the Central Valley was socked in to fog. We had all the chilling hours our fruit trees needed by the second week of December. Okay, we still had January and February for them to accumulate more chilling hours. Meanwhile, all around us in the state was above average temperatures. So there are parts of the state that didn't get anywhere close to the normal number of chilling hours, and they had a disrupted chilling. This is really something we'll be looking at as years go by. Disrupting the chilling hours with spikes of high temperatures or periods where it's just on the edge of providing chilling. We know that chilling isn't a mechanical thing. It's not like there's a switch in the plant that goes, oh, it's below 45, therefore I'm getting what I need. Oh, it's 46 degrees, I'm not getting what I need. It's obviously more of a gradient than an absolute cutoff. We now know that the chilling hours that trees need is about 34 to 50 degrees. That's when they're getting what they need, not 32 to 45 degrees. So that's an example of where contemporary research has changed the model somewhat. But we also know that it's not a cut and dried, hard and fast. Let's choose your metaphor here. It's not an absolute thing, and things can disrupt it, particularly for certain crops. And it did happen with cherries this year. It appears to have happened with pistachio nuts. And another aspect is how the fruit ripens. One of the features of inadequate chilling, for example, is delayed ripening. So clearly, that's not happening here. But in the peach-growing regions of Texas, if they have a year where they don't get enough chilling, the trees will flower, they will fruit, the fruit will ripen, but the quality is impaired, and the ripening period goes on for 3 or 4 weeks, which from a home garden standpoint, that quality impaired thing is not great, but hey, I can pick over 3 to 4 weeks. But if you're a farmer, you don't want to have to send a picking crew through 4 times. You want to send them through once or maybe twice to do the whole crop. So that becomes an issue in agriculture. We do know that chilling hours and process of dormancy is more complicated than we used to think, but we do know that there have been some effects this year statewide from the very strange nature in which we got our chilling this year. I think we should talk about events and things like that. How's that?
We should talk about KDRT.
Yes, KDRT is community radio.
It is.
Public radio, that means that we rely on listeners like you to fund our operating costs. If you like what you hear, head on over to kdrt.org and click on the support button. At the UC Davis Arboretum, you can walk with Warren. He's doing this once a month, September 16th. Mark your calendar next month, noon to 1 p.m. You can immerse yourself in the vivid beauty of the UC Davis Arboretum as you embark on a midday adventure through the gardens and the collections with your humorous guide, Warren Roberts, Superintendent Emeritus. That's September 16th, noon to 1. For event details, you can go to arboretum.ucdavis.edu. You do not need to register or anything like that. It's at the Shields Gazebo, way down the west end of the Arboretum, my absolute favorite part of the Arboretum. To get directions, again, arboretum.ucdavis.edu. The reason that is my favorite end of the Arboretum, by the way, there's a couple of gardens there that are always of interest. That's not to say the rest of the Arboretum isn't cool and wonderful, but there's the Ruth Risden Storer Garden down there next to the Shields Gazebo, which has all kinds of flowering plants and succulents and trees of interest and grasses and things like that that are irrigated as infrequently as possible and managed beautifully by the Arboretum docents in any time of year. You can go down there, park, walk over, and get ideas because there's always something either in bloom or has seasonal color of the foliage or something like that. And then you can walk into where you'd be meeting for this event of Walking with Warren, which is the Shields Gazebo and the Carolee Shields White Garden, which I've watched evolve since literally when it was planted, when I was an undergraduate, into an amazing collection of woody plants with interesting perennials and flowering shrubs around it. It was intended originally as a moonlight garden. I don't know if most people still know that. As a night garden, all the flowers were going to be white. And if you go to a moonlight garden with white flowers at night during a full moon, many of these things like Brugmansias and others will be blooming. They'll have fragrance. It'll be very appealing. In over time, many of the woody plants have grown up, so you're getting some really cool examples of large shrubs and trees. So there's fewer of the flowering plants than there used to be, but still a wonderful place to gather and to take friends from out of town. So if you don't happen to be going to walk around with Warren, at least head down there and look at that cool part of the west end of the Arboretum.
Anytime it's open, anytime. Yep. That's the lovely thing about the Arboretum. By the way, on that white garden, you can find several different kinds of Philadelphus.
True.
So if you want to grow the mock orange from back east, which is a wonderful plant, you can choose which one you want. And they're different. They're all white, but they're different shapes and sizes, and some are double and some are singles. And
yeah, it's a lovely plant. Interesting plant. And we actually have a native Philadelphus. We have a Western native as well, Western species.
Does it grow here?
Yeah. Yeah, it's from the mountain areas of California, but it does grow here in the lowlands as well. I'm going to say it's not as showy. It's not as refined looking as East Coast one, but it's just as fragrant and it is native.
Well, my favorite is out just outside my front door. It's Philadelphus. Virginiana, I think, is the sub name.
That's a big plant.
It was like, I don't know, head high for years and years and years. And then all of a sudden, 5 years ago, it suddenly shot up and it's like, it's huge.
It's a big plant.
It's beautiful.
I have a version of that. Virginalis is the actual name. Philadelphus virginalis. It's one of these plants that has an interesting sunset zone range, 1 through 17. So if you know your sunset zones, that's all the very cold places, 1 through 7 are, you know, way colder than here. And then 15 to 17 is the Bay Area, but it also includes the deserts and the valley. It just doesn't include Southern California and the coastal zones of Southern California. So it basically needs to have some kind of winter dormancy, I gather. Philadelphia has always done great for me. I actually had it planted originally with Pittosporum because they're both called mock orange. And I still have both of those plants. Over 3+ decades, the Pittosporum has definitely outgrown the Philadelphia. The similarity is that they all have flowers that smell like lemon blossoms or orange blossoms. Very sweet, pungent flowers. And they're wonderful. Pittosporum, you can prune anytime during the growing season. You won't cut into the bloom unless you do it literally right before it flowers. It'll flush right back out. You can keep it as a shrub. Mine is trained more like a tree because of where it is, and that works very well. Philadelphia's doesn't bloom on new growth, so if you're cutting it back all the time, you won't get much bloom. So typically with a deciduous flowering shrub like a Philadelphia's, you prune it right after the bloom, and that's the only time. We typically prune it for size control or anything like that. It's okay to clip them, shape them, pinch them if you need to for, you know, later on in the summer if they're getting too tall and rangy for some reason. But if you need to do a hard pruning on that one, you should just do it right after the bloom, or else you're cutting into next year's flowers. Other than that, they're both pretty tough plants. Big difference, Pittosporum tobira, the California version of mock orange, is definitely more drought tolerant and more tolerant in general than the Philadelphus, which I consider more of an understory plant. Both of them are very suitable here, but the tobira you see everywhere. So that's the one everybody knows because it's so widely adaptable.
And the Philadelphus makes wonderful cut flower arrangements. The flowers don't last very long, but they are beautiful. And there's enough growth on any Philadelphus bush that you can always go in there and find a twig or a branch or something to snip off and bring in the house.
Pruning them in bloom is fine. Actually, that's a great time to do it. Prune some in bloom, take them into the house, wait till they're finished. Yeah. Then if you need to do any size control, that's a good time to do it. The native one, just for the record, is Philadelphus louisii or Lewisii, named after Lewis of Lewis and Clark, the explorers. It's called the wild mock orange, according to Sunset. Interesting. Again, zones 1 through 17, exact same sunset climate zones. It's native to Western North America. It's a big one. There's a couple different variants of it out there. Very fragrant blooms, June to July, somewhat drought tolerant, they say here. I would not recommend it for a xeric landscape, that's for sure. It's really more of an understory plant, but it can tolerate drought. What happens if it gets drought stressed, like many deciduous California natives, is that many of the leaves will fall off. Or they'll curl and they'll cup waiting for water. It's unsightly, but the plant is fine. So you'll have to accept that if you're going to a low water landscape. It could be considered in a relatively low water shade garden if you gave it a little more water than perhaps some of the other things there. And that one blooms June to July. And I'm told here it's the state flower of Idaho. So it can tolerate cold winters, that's for sure.
Okay. So Don, I hate to give you a downer.
Sure, let's start with it.
I want to show you some tomato pictures, which are really sad. So this is the tomato disease thing from Charlie.
Yeah.
And there are a whole bunch of pictures here.
Great.
And it appears to be two different ones. The first picture has a leaf. All of it, all the way out, is very sad. It's yellow. It's got holes. It's brown. It's dry. It's,
This looks like late blight. Okay. This looks like late blight on both plants, all plants. Late blight is a disease that splashes onto the leaves. And that second picture you were talking about with the dieback, you could see the point where it actually infected and then continued to die on into the leaf, into the midrib, and even to the petiole. When it hits the petiole of the leaf, the whole leaf will brown and fall off. And that happened on the first picture. And then further in, you're just about to get to this one, was the little spots on the leaves that are beginning to yellow out from there. Those will coalesce into dead areas. That leaf will die back. And you can already see, if you scroll through to about the fourth picture, go ahead, where the stem that holds the leaf is beginning to wither. So that whole leaf is going to yellow and brown. So it has small points of infection, but more importantly, a couple points of infection on the part that sustains the entire leaf or the leaf. Problem with late blight, and this is much more of a problem. Charlie's in Brooklyn. It's much more of a problem with folks in that climate than here, because when we start to get late blight, we get a dry wind or we get, 14% humidity within a couple of days and it tends to stop. That doesn't happen in Brooklyn. And I know you guys have had some extremely wonky weather back there, to put it mildly, humid and hot and rainy and who knows what. I mean, every possible thing that could go wrong with a tomato probably is going wrong with your tomatoes. Problem is, there's no treatment when a plant is infected like this. But you can't go out and buy a fungicide and spray it. And you wouldn't want to do that on something where the fruit is already ripening anyway. You typically just prune it out, the infected portion. Now here I can say that. I can say, oh, look, this part of the plant is affected. The rest of the plant looks fine. Prune out the affected portion, bag it up, and throw it away. In fact, if you'd look at his letter, I think he said something about that.
I should have read that.
Go ahead.
Hi, Don and Lois. One of the gardeners in there, they have a community garden.
Yeah.
One of the gardeners asked me what is wrong with their tomato plants. I told him to cut the branches off and then said, you probably better throw those plants in the dumpster, not the compost. That's very good. The tomatoes did not look good. Yeah. The second picture shows like there might be some kind of insect or bug on it. It's white. And on my way back to the garden, I rubbed the bottom of my work boots on the grass. And then I watched the bottoms with the hose.
Yeah, this tends to splash around. There's nothing wrong with washing off your boots. That certainly helps prevent soil-borne diseases from getting around. And this could be down in the leafy debris on the ground. So washing off your boots is not a bad plan in general. Here you have a disease, it looks like late blight. It's affecting the leaves. It's spreading into some of the leaves. You could move quickly to prune off the leaves that have spots and the branches that are dying back. You could bag all that up. Charlie's suggestion is great. Bag it up and put it in the trash rather than the compost. But the only problem I have is looking at these pictures, like Lois was talking about the third one. That plant's got a lot of dieback. You could probably cut off the leaves, the worst stems, get whatever fruit is on there to ripen, and then be done with it would be the way I would probably proceed at this point. If some of the plants are less affected and have just leaves with spots, take some time, cut off those leaves, monitor. I do see fruit close to ripe, so that will probably go ahead and ripen on your counter if you pick that right now. If it's off of green at all, starting to turn color, it will ripen on your counter. And so that would be one thing we would be right now to go ahead and pick any of the fruit that is still good and not itself infected. Check the fruit as you pick it, wash it, clean it, dry it. This is really important. Dry it, set it on your counter, let it become fully ripe. There are blight-resistant tomato varieties. You can find this information typically in the catalogs, but if this has been a problem for you, and I know it is a way bigger problem in rainier climates than it is for us, a couple of sites that I looked at do mention, for example, Juliet as a good example of one that is resistant to blight. And I would agree, I've certainly never seen any problems on Juliet. If anything, my only problem with Juliet is, what am I going to do with 600 of these things? Mountain Fresh, which is a very popular tomato in the Midwest, apparently introduced from North Carolina, but grown widely in the Midwest and Mid-Atlantic, Mountain Fresh, and I gather Mountain Supreme, these are blight resistant. And those are very good producers of, 6 to 12 ounce fruit, good sized fruit that is a classic round red tomato with good intermediate flavor and is resistant to apparently verticillium, two strains of fusarium, and tolerant of nematodes. So that's a good one to look for. Mountain Fresh, something more common back east than here in California. I've been meaning to grow this one, actually, because I keep hearing about it. It's just not a West Coast variety, particularly. There's a bunch of others. It isn't hard to find blight-resistant tomato varieties, but it's easy to remember Juliet. I mean, if you're giving a top 10 list of tomato varieties, it'll do well pretty much everywhere. Juliet's almost sure to be on that list. A 1999 All-America selection winner. It's a small fruit. It's a 1 ounce fruit. So that's for a different category, perhaps, than these larger slicing tomatoes. But it's just incredibly tolerant, adaptable, productive, and easy to harvest, easy to grow. Freezes whole just great. Makes great sauce because it's actually meaty, even though it's a small fruit. So it's just really turned into an all-purpose, very successful tomato variety. When every now and then someone will post on a nursery Facebook group, all right, nationwide, what are your top five tomatoes? And there's a couple that are on almost every list. Early Girl, Sun Gold, Juliet. Those three everywhere in the country, seemingly, or at least they sell very well. I know that much because these are retailers that are responding, and presumably they grow very well as well. Lots of other choices, but those three, Juliet, Early Girl, Sun Gold, can't go wrong with those. And Juliet has the blight resistance that you're after here. Okay, so Charlie, I hope that helps. Late blight is no fun to deal with. You'll find read all kinds of stuff about how to manage it, which is really challenging. If it's been a problem in a particular set of garden beds in the public gardens there, there might be some discussion about things that can be done. There are organic sprays that are based on copper that can be used early in the season, but this is really the key. Get all of the residue out of there. So whether you let these go further in the season, see if you can eke out some more fruit from them or whatever, it looks like you have late blight. You cut all that down to the ground, you take all that foliage and you bag it up and you get rid of it. You then look at the bed and you look at the leaves that are still on the ground, you take those out of there. You basically get the bed completely clean of anything that might overwinter. Clean it all out. Maybe even grow a cover crop early in the season before you plant your tomatoes next year. Probably not a great plan to plant in the same spot anyway. We know that for other reasons, but this would be yet another reason. Late blight isn't a soil-borne disease like verticillium or fusarium. It's not a soil-borne pest like nematodes. It's overwintering on leaf debris, stem debris. I remember a lengthy discussion on the garden professor's blog on Facebook long ago about, do you need to clean your tomato cages? And I thought, never occurred to me that one might need to do that. Clean the tomato cages. Well, I, you know, so I thought about that. And as the years have gone by, I've gone out there at the beginning of the planting season, realizing many of my tomato cages have stuff from the previous year's tomato plants in them. I just cut them down. I pulled them out, but I didn't get every leaf out of there. I didn't make sure they were clean. So this would be one thing. No, I don't think you need to bleach your tomato cages. There was a lively discussion about that years ago. That just seems like a sort of an excessive step. But getting all the stems and leaves out of there, getting all that out of there, washing them off, drying them in the sun, ultraviolet.
Well, we get so dry that I mean, if it's something sitting on a piece of metal, it's going to fry.
But what I generally have done myself at the end of the season, this is the thing to think about wherever you're listening. I'm usually cutting these down November, maybe as late as December, because our tomatoes continue well into the rainy season. So there's been years when I haven't cut them down until they're basically dead looking. And I'll often just cut them down, pull the stuff out, stack up the cages, and I'm done. But I'm not pulling them out with any specific effort to get all of them out of there. Not a big issue for us. I would strongly suggest that if you have had a problem in this bed, you make every effort to clean out every bit of the tomato plant and related plants, potatoes, peppers, eggplant. Just get the bed completely cleaned up. Get all the vegetative debris out of there and take your cages, get all the stuff off of them, wash them off and stand them in the sun for a while, because we do know that ultraviolet rays are helpful as well. But wherever you're listening, if it's rainy in the summer and late blight or summer leaf diseases are a problem on your tomatoes, get all that out of there, clean off the cages.
Okay, so let's stay with tomatoes for a little bit. And JB has written to us and said, attached for your amusement is a picture of tomato plants which receive 3 hours of sunlight a day, the maximum that my yard has to offer. The plant on the right is a champion, about 4 foot tall. Remember, he's writing the middle of August.
Champion,
about
okay.
4 foot tall. Yeah. It has a set of grand total of 7 fruit.
Yeah.
Rats got the first 3.
Oh.
The fourth has blossom end rot, but I will eat it if it ever ripens. This mid-August, I planted it May 1st. Hopefully the other 3 will ripen soon. The plant on the left is a Juliet, which has done a bit better, setting about 20 very small fruit. 3 have ripened so far. And that plant looks like it's maybe 3 feet tall.
Yeah.
And then it says, I have had marginally better luck here in the past with Early Girl yielding about 15 small fruit and have tried but failed with various cherry tomatoes. Oh, well, I'll just wait until next year. Cherry tomatoes didn't work.
There's always next year.
And this is, and John is in Fair Oaks, by the way.
Oh, yeah. Okay. So Sacramento area. So these plants aren't as vigorous as I would expect, even in the shade. So I'm wondering about perhaps the depth of irrigation. Maybe there's root competition. I didn't look closely to see whether there's anything on the other side of the fence that might be competing with them. There's one conversation.
Can't see the top of the fence.
Yeah. One conversation with someone who was having these kinds of problems a little while ago, it turned out their neighbors had a whole long row of privets along the fence.
Oh my.
Yeah, and privets, although I don't know for sure that they put any kind of toxin in the soil, I know their roots are aggressive and it's very hard to garden under or near privets, just like bay trees, redwoods, certain other things. Another customer who was dealing with coast redwood, same issue, you know, plants never did well there. They finally went to raised planters And the redwood roots, of course, it came right up into the raised planters. So this was where the conversation started, was now what do you do? I said, well, now what you do in your situation is you have to have a bottom on your planter, unfortunately. So you're going to be growing in containers, not in the planters in the open ground, unless, of course, you can move it somewhere else. So that became a whole separate conversation. The main point being you're suddenly going from a plant that can root deeply to a plant that's in a pot. Totally different conversation for managing it. I think that next year you should send us a note in March asking us in 3 hours of sun, which tomato varieties would we recommend?
That's good.
I would start with bushier types to begin with. I would probably up your irrigation from what it looks like. So be sure to remind us how you're irrigating. And it looks like you probably could have used a little more nitrogen. By the way, it's August. For me, I would take fish emulsion or something similar to it, or a dry tomato vegetable food, and I would go ahead and give those plants some fertilizer right now. And I'd give them
and water
5 to 10 gallons of water all at once, each one of them. And this is just an experiment. If you get new growth and if you get flowering and fruit production, aside from the fact that you do have enough time to, you know, get them to ripen, you'll now know that part of your problem was inadequate depth of irrigation. Nitrogen would just help stimulate things and keep that going. So I would suggest experiment. That Champion still has a chance. Champion is one of my favorites for its late season production. I'm glad to see you have that one, because it's one of the ones where every year I've been doing it more methodically over the last few years of writing notes mid-August. And then again, like the 1st of October, how did this variety do? How did that variety do? And Champion invariably goes from August notes, middle number of fruit. I've harvested a few, growing very well, good color. October, usually one of my top yielding tomatoes for the season, but mostly rather late. It spends its time on early growth. I see yours didn't do that, but you still have a chance for it to do that here. Champion is a really good addition to a combination that would include any of the girls, early girl, new girl, Juliet or Sun Gold or some smaller fruited type. And again, you can't really go wrong with Juliet and Champion. Those three would give you a lot of fruit typically. In the early girl, in a normal year, we'd be heavy fruit production in late July and August. Gap, maybe then another crop late in the season because it tends not to set as well during high temperature periods. Champion getting going, setting midsummer, heavy production late in the season, and Juliet or Sun Gold or something like that, just heavily from the time you plant it practically. I'm going to mention one more that I'm looking at right here on my table. I'm going to show this to Lois here. I turn this around. All right. You see there, you see all those tomatoes.
Oh, that's a nice collection, Don. Yeah, you've been busy.
Oh, there's more over there. So these are tomatoes I'm picking to stay ahead of the turkeys and the squirrels. And that basket over there, the little round yellow ones.
Yeah.
That's one that's called Honey Delight.
They look sort of orangish gold.
Yeah. And if you look at the size of the fruit on this, they're biggish cherry, like a large cherry tomato. And they are extremely sweet and almost no tartness. So some people prefer that, and some people prefer more tart and more depth to the flavor. What I'm finding is this one is insanely productive. Honey Delight. This is just
Honey
like
Delight.
2 minutes of picking yesterday evening. And there's probably 400 on this vine at this time. And they are varying stages of ripeness, and they're very, very, very sweet. And interestingly, they cook really well. The guy who recommended this to me, Jeff, thank you, Jeff. A few years ago, I started growing it a couple of years back, and I've been increasingly impressed year after year if you happen to like this type of tomato. And he said, one of these things you can do with this, just like Juliet, Honey Delight can be put in the freezer whole. Just go ahead and put them on cookie sheets, put them in the freezer till they're frozen solid. Take them out, run some water. The skin comes right off when they're frozen, and you can cook them. And you can throw them into sauce and salsa and things like that as well. So this is Honey Delight. It's one I wasn't real familiar with until about 5 years ago. He's touted it, and I finally grew one to its what you might call full capacity this year. Full capacity appears to be approximately 500 fruit.
Oh, my word. My word.
Yeah, I'll set some
so
aside
for you. That's going to have to be a big bush, right?
It's about a 6-foot plant. Now, my Champion, as an example, is right now about 8 feet. So that's what you should be getting by the mid to late part of August, 6 to 8 foot on any indeterminate tomato. So if it's not giving you that, something's missing from its cultivation, probably depth of irrigation and nitrogen.
Okay. Well, that was the fun stuff. Now we get to the sad stuff. You want to explain why I have in front of me something about jumping worms? I mean, I always thought those were larvae inside the beans or something.
Jumping worms. Oh, yes. Somebody sent a question. Larva inside the bean. Ah, that's jumping beans. And then there's jumping galls. Don't be confused by jumping galls and jumping beans. Those are different critters. Jumping worm is something folks back east are more familiar with.
It's an actual worm that jumps?
Yes. Yes. It flings itself around like crazy. First of all, jumping galls, I should mention those because those are kind of a unique California thing. And right about the time of year for those, I'll have to head down to the cemetery and see if they're down there. That's a little tiny gall. Galls are caused by a little tiny wasp that will sort of sting, if you will, or oviposit onto the leaf of certain trees. Oaks host numerous types of galls. The plant leaf portion grows around the little larval thing and then drops, in the case of the jumping gall. And you're walking along and you see what looks like little things about the size of a grain of sand, except that you notice they're hopping up and down, which is very confusing. And there may be hundreds, if not thousands, of them hopping up and down on the sidewalk. There's a bunch of
Wow.
these oaks down by the Davis Cemetery. So on the sidewalk out there, it seems like every couple of years someone walks in with some of these, says, "What the heck are these things? They're seeds, but they're jumping. They're seeds." Well, they're not seeds in this case. In the case of jumping beans, yes, it's something that's in the bean. Those are harmless. They're one of many interesting galls that we get on oak trees and many other trees. I have galls on my elms right now. I get galls on my walnuts. None of them are harmful in any particular way. They're just an interesting thing that happens to live on the tree. It's not even really parasitic, I guess. It's not really harming the tree, except you get a little loss of chlorophyll right in the leaf where they are. That's about it. So they're nothing to worry about. Jumping worms, on the other hand, this is a pest that has shown up in the United States a number of years ago. Department of Food and Agriculture has really interesting information about it. It is a very vigorous worm that does indeed, when you disturb it, they fling themselves around. They do jump up in the air as much as a few inches. And if it were just doing that, we wouldn't be that concerned about it. This is primarily a threat to forests and commercial nurseries. It's not an issue for home gardeners, except we need to be aware of it because it is in California now. It's in different places. And locally, a property manager contacted me that one of the residents of one of the properties they manage had found them in their yard and wanted them to immediately implement action against the jumping worms. Because if you go online and read about them, they're a major threat to forests, to woodland areas, and they rapidly decay the duff much more quickly than regular earthworms do. So that's the damage that they do. So they deplete the soil nutrients very rapidly because of the rate at which they feed, and they spread very aggressively, and they outcompete the worms that are present. Side note, the worms locally that they're outcompeting are not
They're not
actually native. They're
native.
not native, so just be aware of that. So, I don't want people to turn this into a oh my God, they're going to outcompete all the native worms. They got outcompeted a long time ago. This would be threatening the other worms that you have in your garden. But it will rapidly decay organic material, decay, digest, if you will, organic material in your soil and change the structure of the soil. And they leave these droppings. Their worm castings are apparently not particularly desirable. Their worm castings are sort of granular and change the structure of the soil in an undesirable manner. My suggestion here is that this is not a huge threat to California agriculture, not a huge threat to California landscapes or gardens, but it is something that we need to know about. And it will be a problem up in forested areas, particularly. Some orchard operations might be affected by it. I don't know. Rather than having a landscape manager take on management of a pest they're not familiar with, I suggest you contact the County Agricultural Commissioner's office, wherever you're listening, if jumping worms are found, for two reasons. One, normal worms jump around a lot when you dig them up and it's hot and dry. They're unhappy to be out of the soil. So you need to know you for sure have this type of worm, not just seeing a really active, angry worm flopping around on the ground. It may or may not be a jumping worm. So that's the first thing. They'd want to know for sure that that's actually what you have. They will tell you what your best approach is at that point. So we don't want people poisoning the soil to kill these things. We don't want people taking action without professional and, in fact, regulatory guidance on this. So this person who wrote to the property manager said, "You need to do the following things in the landscape." I would actually urge that specific practices, if deemed necessary, be provided to your landscape managers by the agricultural commissioner. Your county has an agricultural commissioner who is aware of this or wants to be aware of it if they aren't already aware of it. So that's the first thing. You can find them in the phone book Everybody has phone books, right? Yolo County Agricultural Commissioner. In our county, they're very friendly, very helpful. It's a small office. You're almost certain to talk to the same person every two or three times you call. They've got lots of good advice. They'll know what to do. Or if they don't, they'll know who to contact. They can evaluate the risk from this worm in our area and provide guidance. So contact either CDFA, California Department of Food and Agriculture, or your local Ag Commissioner's office, probably the best approach, to report the finding. If the CDFA, now I'm reading from UCANR, if the CDFA confirms the worms are jumping worms, work with them to focus on preventing spread of the worm. That's going to be a matter of not moving materials, not moving compost, mulch, topsoil, or plants known to have jumping worms to new locations. That's what makes them a problem with the nursery industry. We haven't had issues with this, but obviously if big wholesale growers do, we'll be the first to know. Always, this gets back to what was being discussed earlier in a community garden, always clean dirt and debris off your equipment and shoes before leaving an area infested with jumping worms, because their egg masses are small and readily moved on boots, rototillers, things like that. Dispose of all contaminated soil and castings in the trash. I would take that guidance from the CDFA or the Ag Commissioner specifically, but that's what UCANR is telling you. Here in California, we just want to try and prevent the spread of the jumping worm. But you'll be reading more about this one because it's been found in a few locations around the state at this point.
So we have one more question for the show, and that is, I'm looking for a low shrub for a slope. This is in Sonoma County. Can you compare these possibilities? Nerium dwarf red, spirea, mock orange, and St. John's wort. Deer are an issue. Drought tolerance would be good just because it's a tricky spot to water.
So let's go through those one at a time. Nerium is an oleander. Everybody knows the big oleanders. Which one did he mention? Little red?
Dwarf red.
Yeah, okay. There's one called Little Red, and then there's the Petite series. These are dwarf oleanders. Yes, oleanders are poisonous. Can we just get that out of the way? Yes, they're poisonous. We all know that.
Okay. Are they poisonous to deer?
I hope so.
I think any deer that tried to eat something would go, ew, pew.
No, I'm guessing it's this deer's stomach being what they can. They could probably eat oleanders. I don't know. Anybody in deer country, give us some feedback on whether deer eat oleander. Good question. They're very bitter, but that's a side discussion. I had a customer, I'll only briefly do this, they had a resort up at Lake Berryessa, and she and I, which is a major deer pressure on any landscape up there, and she would go over the lists of deer-resistant plants with me that they had in Sunset Western Garden Book and places. She would go, yep, yep, nope, yep, nope, 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 they eat those, yep, yep, yep. I mean, so we came to the conclusion that hungry deer will eat almost anything.
Yeah.
We'll try anything. That's what she said. So we're not going to go into a whole thing about deer because we don't deal with them here. But her comment was, what you need is plants that come back after being eaten. So yeah. If they ate down the daylilies, they'd sprout back up and bloom again. If they ate the gazanias or verbena, they'd come back up and bloom again. If you had a rose bush, you'd never see a flower. So you learn to adapt to them rather than the other way around, unless you really wanted to get into multiple layers of deer fencing. So I don't know if they're going to be eaten by deer. That's not an area where I have any expertise, thank goodness. But this little series and the petite series of oleanders are interesting because these are shrubs that get about 3 to 4 feet with equal spread, maybe 5 to 6 feet with great age, easily kept down. So like the bottle brush, easily a dwarf version of the big one, great garden plants, bloom like the regular oleanders from about May all the way through the summer. And as tough as can be and extremely drought tolerant and moderately shade tolerant. I seem to recall that light shade was a possibility here. Nothing wrong with oleander in that situation. The ones you'd be looking for would be the little series or the petite series. Important thing to know about them, they're a little more frost tender than regular oleanders. So regular oleanders are hardy in zone 9, USDA zone 9 and 10, but get killed back or damaged in zone 8. These can be damaged in zone 9, especially 9A. If we get into the low 20s, you'll get some top injury on them. I've had this discussion with people who planted these petite or little series as, say, a small hedge or something. We get down to 25, 24, 23 degrees, which happens here every couple of years, and they get a lot of leaf burn, but they just come right back. So just be aware that that is a possibility, both over where you are in Sonoma and here. If we have an unusually cold spell in the winter, you can get some leaf injury. They will recover usually. In 1990, notably, they did not. Petite Ceres and
Little Ceres. 1990 was bizarre.
16 degrees wiped them out. Regular oleanders were damaged but resprouted, but the Petite Ceres and the Little Ceres were killed. So that was unfortunate for people who were growing them. Nurseries in particular were overwintering hundreds and hundreds of them and ended up throwing all of those out. I'm guessing oleander isn't a top choice for a lot of you listening. So let's move on to number two.
Spirea. You know, that's one of my favorite plants because of where I lived. I lived back in Michigan, and we had spirea, and it's beautiful.
They're all over the place back east, and people do grow them out here. There's a whole lot of spireas. I mean, so many varieties, it's a little bit overwhelming, but they do break down into two categories, old-fashioned and big, newer ones that are small. Okay, old-fashioned and big are spectacular plants. Van Hootii is a good example. Gets 6 feet by 7 feet, arching branches. Every branch has got hundreds of blooms on it for that 4 to 5 week period of bloom. Often planted as a hedge, I'm told. I think they're great as freestanding plants being allowed to grow more naturally. The fall color on that plant is really showy. One of the first things I noticed about it when I moved up here and started getting acquainted with these unusual deciduous flowering shrubs that nobody grows in San Diego. And spireas were an interesting group of plants. To me, those big ones are really showy, attractive landscape plants. They're bare in the winter, of course, they're deciduous, but the fall color makes up for that. And that 4 or 5 week bloom in the spring is spectacular. Dwarf spireas were coming on the market in the 1970s and 80s in a big way. And there's probably 15 or 20 varieties now. They basically break down into white or pink flowered. Whether they repeat bloom, the pink one in particular, continues to bloom right on through the summer. And what color the foliage is, because mostly they're a light green, but some of them have golden tinged foliage. So there's a bunch of cultivars of spirea, heavily introduced for the East Coast and the upper Midwest and places like that, because spireas are incredibly hardy and very adaptable. Take well to pruning if you want to. These dwarf ones, you can clip them if you want to. Spirea will work. They tend to be a little scrawny looking in the nursery. This is something we've run into. They don't sell well. Certainly not in California.
And they get bare in the winter.
Yeah, they're deciduous. And so deciduous flowering shrubs, that's another issue. You know, people have to realize it's only December through February. It's not like, you know, they're bare into May, but deciduousness is a characteristic that Californians apparently are perplexed by. We don't understand it. Why are they dropping their leaves? We're in a subtropical climate here, right?
Is St. John's wort also deciduous?
Sort of. We'll come to that one in a moment. But spireas are a good choice. They'll work almost anywhere if you happen to like the look of them. The dwarf ones are really easy to manage. I think the big ones are more attractive landscape plants. Certainly they would work in light shade, and they also work for me in full sun. So there's a good possibility there. What was the other one? Hypericum?
St. John's wort.
Yeah, so that's an interesting thing. St. John's wort is an actual specific hypericum, Hypericum perforatum. It's used medicinally. It also is a rangeland weed. So interestingly, it's the only plant that the local agricultural commissioner has ever told me directly in the form of a letter when we opened our nursery and updated periodically that we legally cannot sell.
Oh.
It's a scheduled weed, in a Schedule B weed in California, which means that the state has said it's a noxious weed, but it's up to the ag commissioner in each county to decide whether they need to be concerned about it. If they have any ranching operations in their county, they probably will prohibit the growing and sale of Hypericum perforatum, St. John's wort.
But there's others, Hypericums.
Yes, yes. So this is one. If someone asks me for St. John's wort, I have to clarify, are you looking for the medicinal St. John's wort? It's used as an antidepressant. First of all, go read all about that. I'm not talking to you about your medicine, but there are issues with that that you need to know about. More to the point, I can't sell it. Solano County, they can sell it, because that ag commissioner has decided it doesn't matter. Yolo County, we do have a large ranching operation up on the west side of the county, up by Lake Berryessa. And to protect them from possible invasion of their ranch lands by Hypericum perforatum, I cannot sell it, nor can any nursery in Yolo County. Curious thing. But the term is used sometimes as a common name for anything in the genus Hypericum, not just Hypericum perforatum. There's a ground cover Hypericum, a lot of you know, sometimes called Aaron's beard, only gets about a foot tall, spreads very freely.
Bright yellow, fluffy? Yeah.
State of Oregon used it a lot along the highways up there because they get enough rain for it to look good even through the summer without irrigation. Here, I don't really recommend it because it does spread more than most people want. And it's not what he's thinking of here anyway. But the shrub forms, of which there are two, Calycinum, Moserianum, actually three, Henryi, they all look very, very similar. Round shrub, 3 to 4 feet, equal spread. The best planting of them that we always encounter here in Davis is near the Nugget Market parking lot near CVS. In that parking lot, there's a bunch of these there, and nobody notices them until May when they come into bloom and they're covered with yellow flowers. And we can expect a parade of people coming in going, what is this yellow flowered shrub? And that's the only time of year we ever sell them. The rest of the year, they don't look like anything you would buy. But they are a tough shrub, very adaptable, 4 to 5 week bloom, kind of like the spirea. Definitely can take full sun. Looks best if you water them, but they do come back from drought. I can attest, because there are times when that parking lot barely seems to be getting irrigated. Other times when it seems to be getting irrigated just fine, as we often encounter in commercial settings like that. So it's a possibility. Does that one big bloom, again, a round plant, tight growth habit, easily clipped if you want to shape it, it would certainly fit, and light shade would be okay. What was the fourth one?
Well, no, is the Hypericum deciduous or not?
Mostly, sort of, semi-deciduous. And that's an interesting
decision.
Well, yes.
You mean whether it gets watered or not?
No, whether it gets, how cold we get. There are shrubs that drop leaves in colder climates that don't drop leaves here. So they often are described as semi-deciduous. So they're in that category. There's two categories of sort of deciduous that we have to deal with here in California. One is the ones that are, our winters are warmer than the plant is accustomed to, so it just doesn't drop its leaves. I'm told there are places where Abelia, for example, is deciduous. Not here, completely evergreen right on through the winter. Then there's the subtropical plants that are supposed to be evergreen, but they get their leaves damaged by the cold. So we don't call those deciduous because their leaf cycle is not part of the plant. It's just weather injury. My staff often have just taken the saying bougainvilleas are deciduous. I mean, that's fine. They're not technically deciduous, but we want people to understand the leaves.
They lose their leaves in the winter, and we'll call that deciduous.
They're not supposed to, but they do, and it's okay. They'll come back. So there's that issue. But yeah, so Hypericum is semi-deciduous.
All right. And then the fourth one, we come to those terms again, mock orange. Now, which mock orange?
What? In his case, he was actually referring to the native dwarf Philadelphus. So there is a shorter version, Goose Creek, of the Philadelphus luisii, which is our Western native Philadelphus mock orange. Fragrant flowers, very similar to the ones back east, tighter growing plant, very prunable. Light shade would probably be preferable for that in terms of just the summer appearance here. Wonderful fragrance to the flowers. More open, lankier, less tight, compact growth habit. So as a landscape plant, it isn't as attractive, but it makes a nice plant to mix with other things that have a tighter growth habit. No reason you couldn't have a couple of these things in there. If he had happened to mean by mock orange, Pittosporum, and he's talking about the dwarf, then that's Wheeler's dwarf, or the variegated form called Turner's dwarf, plant that gets 2 to 3 feet, 3 to 4 foot spread. So widely planted in California that we have had a few problems crop up on them, but not very many. And, you know, pretty much indestructible. The difference is I've almost never seen Wheeler's dwarf flower. It is just not a plant that gives much in the way of bloom. So if you're looking for the fragrance of the bloom or the showy flower, the spirea, the Hypericum, the Philadelphus would all be better choices. Nothing wrong with the mock orange in the case of the dwarf one, in the dwarf Pittosporum tubira, Wheeler's dwarf, but it barely blooms. In the case of the Philadelphus, you get that wonderful springtime bloom. There's plenty of other low shrubs. It's a whole other conversation at some point. So we'll just start with those four. Let's compare and contrast things, but we'll come back to the topic another time.
So Don usually sends me a picture of a beautiful flower, and this time he sent me, well, it's an inflorescence, but the flowers are like pinhead size. And it is purple leafed with a purple flower stalk, and it's amaranth. Yeah. But Don, the one in front is purple, but the two behind are green. Is there something wrong with this plant?
No, it's supposed to be purple. That's normal. It's a cultivar that has burgundy colored foliage and burgundy colored flowers.
Oh, so these are separate plants. These are not shoots of the
two
same
separate plants. Yeah, same plant or three separate plants here. I've been growing celosias for a few years and started doing amaranth a couple of years ago. They're great late summer and early fall flowers for the Sacramento Valley and warmer parts of Southern California. And they do fine on the coast as well. But these just love the summer heat, and they're reasonably drought tolerant. They're deep rooted. Amaranthus roots will help break through heavy soil. They're used as a cover crop sometimes. Yes, of course, amaranth is a grain that you can eat, and you can grow it for that purpose. And if you grow amaranth of any kind and let it go to seed, one, It'll reseed itself very happily, not to the point of being a nuisance, but you'll get seedlings coming up. And I can tell you, this one, the purple-leafed one, the seedlings come true purple as well. Also, birds will love them if you let them go to seed. I don't know what the birds are, but they're little guys. I'm about this big, Lois. What do you think they are? You don't think
them? A summer or winter?
End of fall.
So okay, that right. Would be yellow-rumped warblers.
Okay, and they're having a great
because time. They only come to us in the fall, and they winter over here.
Oh, migratory. Okay, so yeah. They come through here like October, November, which perhaps.
Oh no, fall starts much earlier for birds.
Okay.
Much earlier.
I always put some in sometime in June or as late as the 1st of July for their late summer and fall color that they provide, and then they're one of those plants that just looks kind of cool as we get into the rainy season. They look cool as they die. There are some plants that are like that. They look cool as they're finishing up their season, and there's lots of wildlife that appreciates them. So amaranthus, they're pretty tall. So this is the kind of thing you would either direct seed or transplant out to the back of a border that's 4 to 6 feet deep, have shorter flowering plants in front of it. These stand 4 to 5 feet tall when they're in full bloom. They're a really big, dramatic background thing. A whole niche of plants that is late August through October. Can be a challenging time to get color in the garden. Generally, our soil is really dry. It's the end of the season. In a normal summer, by the end of August, many plants are looking kind of rough. In our area, thrips and spider mites can be making your marigolds and your dahlias look pretty rough right now. Hasn't been real bad this year, but normally by the end of August, early September, they've done their big peak of bloom. You're looking at them, they look kind of rough. If that's the case, by the way, go ahead and cut them back, wash them off, give them some kind of fertilizer. It doesn't really matter that much what it is. I usually use something like fish emulsion, or I have a corn liquor based one that I like. And that will give you another burst of new growth and bloom on those plants, the marigolds, the dahlias, things like that. But there's this whole category, the late summer daisies, like the rudbeckias and the Shasta daisies, the earliest of the chrysanthemums are already starting to show some color. You get a lot of these kinds of late summer heat loving plants that don't mind the cooling conditions of fall. Amaranthus, celosias are in that category. And mid August is a great time to plant big flowered marigolds for that late October bloom we're aiming for with Dia de los Muertos for the first part of November. Asters love it. Penstemon is often still blooming. Our native epilobiums, better known as zauschneria, great choices for that time of year. So there are plants that bridge that gap, and the pollinators in particular will really appreciate it if you focus on that a little bit as you choose your plants.
And don't forget the autumn sage, the salvia plants are some of those that are wonderful fall bloomers.
Yeah. Cosmos is blooming now. I'm looking out the window. See what? Oh, of course, Mexican sunflower. If you haven't grown this plant and you have room for it.
Tithonia, is that it?
Yeah. There's never been a lot of breeding done on it. Basically, there's orange and yellow. And it's a tall plant, 6 feet plus. So you got to give it plenty of room, but it is one of the most pollinator friendly flowers you'll ever get. Whether it's the color or there's some markings on those petals that we're not seeing that the insects are seeing, I don't know what it is, but whenever it's in bloom, there are butterflies, hoverflies, all kinds of things around those flowers. So Mexican sunflower continues blooming for me on through September with no problem.
Barbara Damrosch says, good gardening is very simple, really. You just have to think like a plant.
You've been listening to the Davis Garden Show with Don Shore
and Lois Richter here at KDRT LP 95.7 in Davis, California.